The winningest team in baseball also has the most saves, and people who save the most money are winners. So start earning saves by investing in Worthy Bonds for only $10 each. These bonds earn a fixed 7% APY, and there's no fees, penalties, or minimum balance required, and they can be redeemed whenever you like. You can even round up everyday purchases to buy additional bonds. Go to worthybonds.com/save. That's worthybonds.com/save, and save and win. The winningest team in baseball also has the most saves, and people who save the most money are winners. So start earning saves by investing in Worthy Bonds for only $10 each. These bonds earn a fixed 7% APY, and there's no fees, penalties, or minimum balance required, and they can be redeemed whenever you like. You can even round up everyday purchases to buy additional bonds. Go to worthybonds.com/save. That's worthybonds.com/save, and save and win.
When you buy a used car, don't be taken for a ride. Get Ford Blue Advantage certified at Wade Ford, Atlanta's headquarters for factory-certified pre-owned vehicles. Go to wadeford.com. There, you'll find a great selection of Ford Blue Advantage certified used cars, trucks, and SUVs. With Blue certified, nearly all makes and all models are in stock now. You'll find something perfect for just about any budget. Buy with confidence at the Wade Ford factory-certified used car outlet at wadeford.com. Wade Ford. We are Atlanta's Ford dealer.
All right, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Welcome to Matlanta. I would be Matt or Matlanta. I didn't give myself the nickname. I earned the nickname. Let's not waste any time. Let's get to this week's edition of Welcome to Matlanta.
All right, let's talk about Jamal Anderson, the kid, because I know this, just been reading and talking to you in years past. Your childhood was probably a little bit different than mine based on what your dad did. Your dad was a police officer and a bodyguard. So give our listeners an idea.
Right.
Like, tell me true or false. Muhammad Ali in the waiting room when Jamal Anderson's born?
You know, that's funny because that became like the folklore story. But my brother's name is actually, his middle name is Muhammad Ali. And he was in the waiting room when he was born. But he came to visit me not long after when I was born. But he was in the waiting room for my younger brother, who was a couple of years behind me. But I was like, man, it became one of those things, especially after the Super Bowl where it like took off. But yeah, my dad was working like they were doing a parade for Ali, and I guess it got out of hand with the crowd, and he intervened to aid Ali, and they started talking as I guess they were like bunkered down at this place waiting for other people, and Ali was talking to him about taking leave of absences, and then offered him a job, and next thing you know, he took off. And from Muhammad Ali, he worked with the Jacksons and Donna Summers, Diana Ross, Richard Pryor. It was crazy because we were watching this Richard Pryor's documentary that came on Showtime. And, you know, if you know anything about Richard Pryor, one of his most famous sets was live at the Sunset Strip. Well, the weekend before he bombed. He was just coming back from running down the street on fire. he bombed, and my dad was the one who came out on stage. So I'm watching this documentary, and I'm like, I know all the stuff about Rich Pryor because we grew up around him or was in the house, but this I did not know. And they were like, yeah, he had a rough first night. And James came to get him. And I see my dad walk out on stage, and I was like, wow, it was crazy.
Yeah.
So we grew up around a lot of people. So for me, it was almost like going to college to be a public figure, you know?
How, tell me what kind of athlete Jamal Anderson was as an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old.
Well, I started playing football when I was 7. I started playing football when I was 7. I am not suggesting anybody, although a little Jamal did as well. But I played baseball, too. I played baseball. And for, like, I think from the time we moved to California, when I was, like, 8 years old, I basically did year-round sports. I did football, basketball, baseball, and then I ran track. And then I did football basketball, baseball, ran track, you know, like I was trying to just do everything. And I was on a, I had a lot of success as a kid in Pop Warner playing football. We had some really good football teams, but my basketball team was like famous when we were kids because we didn't lose a game for like 5 or 6 years. We were like vicious down there, you know? And I remember the first time we lost, it was like in the paper. We were all devastated. But I played all the sports. I played all the sports. I was center field baseball. I like to consider myself a pretty good baseball player. Even one of my coaches to this day, like, you know, oh, I know you had success playing football, but you could have still been playing. I'm like, dude, I'm like 40, you know? But he's like, oh, you look good. You could have still been playing. You see how long their careers are? I'm like, oh. So that's always nice, you know?
But let me ask you, when did you realize that football could be a place where you could get a scholarship, and what was the like whole Jamal Anderson recruiting process like? Because from California end up at Utah, that's an interesting journey.
Yeah, so you know what's crazy? Like, even though I played all those other sports, there was just something different to me when I played football. I like to think, and if you went back, like some biographer went back and talked to my coaches, I think they would all say that I acquitted myself fairly well and was one of the top players. Even when my little chubby self ran track, I was moving, you know. I might have been first or second leg on the relay, but I was on there, and I was easily the thickest child on there, you know. But, you know, when I was playing football, like, I loved Jim Brown, and this – relationship with Richard Pryor and my dad working with him, he became good friends with Jim Brown. So like I'm my Pop Warner game, like Jim Brown is at like my game, and I'm 10 years old. You know what I mean?
That's crazy.
So it wasn't like pressure. And you know, my dad worked for Sugar Ray Leonard. I can't believe I even skipped him out, which is terrible. My dad told me before he passed that, you know, his favorite client, he loved Mike Tyson and obviously Muhammad Ali, but him and Ray were so close in age and the time and coming up together. Ray was one of his favorite, but like Sugar Ray used to come in our games. Like my dad and Ray, they rode bicycles to get us from school one day, and the school went nuts. But like on the football field, it was just different for me. Like I was, if any of my dad's clients, family, anybody was going to ask, oh, what sport should we come watch you? I'd be like, oh, you want to come to this game on Saturday? I'm coming to play. You know, I just loved the physicality. Since I put on equipment, I've enjoyed to that hitting and being on the field and being physical and trying to impose my will. Like I'm literally, if you look at, there's like a tape, somebody, one of the kids, the dads who grew up with me, West Valley Eagles in California, he has like 9-year-old football tapes of us. And last time I was in California, I was like, no way. I'm watching this grainy tape. But Matt, I am tearing those kids. You would have thought I was playing against the Saints, dog. I was bringing it.
I love it.
I swear. I was a little bit of a terror, but it was kind of, that's how I was.
Home field advantage exists in baseball. Insurance, too. Your local trusted choice independent insurance agents are active members of your community. They'll always have your back. Find a local auto, home, or business insurance agent at trustedchoice.com.
Folks, you just heard from Smoltzy, and you heard it from me as well. Clayton Rhodes and the Rhodes Group are my trusted choice for insurance agents. They've been my agent for a long time, and they serve all of Metro Atlanta. To get up to 10 auto insurance quotes in less than 10 minutes, visit rhodes-group.com/churnoff today. That's rhodes-group.com/churnoff. It's a new year, which means it's time to try something new. And I'm talking to you folks who have not yet tried the Daily Draft in downtown Woodstock. I hope you'll go see my friend Sean Daly. That's, get it, the Daily Draft. This is the ultimate sports bar experience. So as the football playoffs near, and then baseball's around the corner, knock on wood, and all the fun springtime things that will happen in Atlanta, you're going to want to enjoy it at the Daily Draft. It's downtown Woodstock on Main Street. What you're going to find? A craft beer bar, self-serve taps, big screens all around you to catch every view of the big game. And when I say a big screen, they have a movie-sized screen with a front-row seat right in front of it that you can grab if you get there at the right time to enjoy all your favorite games. A chef-inspired menu with soup, salad, sandwiches, flatbreads, you name it, they have everything to find everybody exactly what they want when you're going with the family, a boys' night, or a date night. TheDailyDraft.net is where you can find all the information about some of the nights like Trivia Night, Kids Eat Free Night, and more. TheDailyDraft.net. Go find them downtown Woodstock on Main Street. Tell them Matt sent you. You'll love The Daily Draft.
Talk to me about the first letter, the first recruiting letter you got. And you ended up, like I said, at Utah, but who else was after Jamal Anderson?
Well, you know, I wanted to go to USC. So once we got to California, and I love Jim Brown, but Marcus Allen was my guy. And then, you know, once he became a Raider, you know, that was like my focus. Even though we, you know, my dad was friends and cool, I went to Eric Dickerson's house, and I loved watching Dickerson play and going to see Rams games. You know, we were kind of, again, my dad's connections. He was good friends with Jim Hill, who's still one of the big sports names in Los Angeles. But I used to get to go on the sidelines and in the locker room with him at games when he was covering the games. So I'm like, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And I'm like sitting there taking pictures with Marcus Allen in the Raiders locker room. And I couldn't even talk to him because I loved him so much. And I didn't ever watch Jim Brown play, but Marcus Allen was coming up when I was very impressionable. And so for me, that like cemented the 32 number for me. Like, I loved the old highlight tapes of Jim Brown. That's when I was like, this is who I want to play like. But, like, I watched Marcus Allen come up. So I wanted to go to USC. That was like, I was like, okay, this is where I'm going to go. But, you know, I didn't handle business my first couple years of high school. I literally was like Ferris Bueller, man. And my dad and mom were like, we're not even going to ground you. Like, what's going on? Like, you've been everybody's All-American. What's the deal? Like, you need to find yourself, you know? And so I got behind immediately. So I had to play catch-up, which I did. And I'm getting recruited by all of these schools. And I had missed some core things. And it was like this big whole stink when I was in high school. And I had to end up going to junior college for 1 year. And so that changed my recruiting pendulum. But when I went there my first year, we were so dominant. And I played so well with another guy in the backfield, Freddie Bradley. I mean, to this day, too bad me and him didn't get to play together. We were nasty. He went to Arkansas, and I started getting attention from SEC schools. And then Cal, at the USC's, UCLA's, Utah, all these other schools. So I ended up staying in JUCO for 2 years. And I'm like, I'm on a roll now with my, like, I had a great structure with respect to my classwork and my tutors and what I wanted to do. And I had set myself up pretty well to when I got to college, to a major university, I was like, huh, I'll be out of there in a year and a half because I have been so far ahead credit-wise and stuff. So, like, it was one time I messed up in school, never again. Like, it cost me, and then I was like, okay, this won't happen again. And so I've remained on the dean's list. But when I was getting recruited, I had made this pact with a couple of my friends who were, like, JUCO All-Americans. We were like, we're at these camps and all this other stuff. We become friends. And we're like, we're going to take wherever we decide, we get all these letters, who's getting offered where. We decided we were going to take some trips together. All right, four or five of us are going to go to Hawaii. Now, here's the thing, man. And I don't know how kids are now, but, you know, you can do in-states, you get 5 trips. And, you know, you could do in-states, and they don't really count against you. So then you can kind of take more trips. And I was on a mission to go to Hawaii with my friends. And I thought, you know, at the time, Hawaii ran the ball a lot, and they were kind of coming up. But it wasn't, to be honest with you, a school I was seriously considering. I wanted to go to the beach with my friends. So Utah, I promise. I was like, all right, man, there's like 8 of us getting offered to Utah. Let's plan to go the same time. And I was like, no way, for real? So we're all on, remember back in the day, you were on landlines clicking in on 3-way with other people, you know? So we make this plan, and it was like, we could go skiing up there. I was like, okay, I'll do that. I can do that as my other trip. I'll do that because they offer me too. And I wasn't even thinking about Utah. Not even thinking about them. I was like going to go skiing and kick it up in the snow with the homies, you know? So I get there, man, and I'm like, you know, it's a bunch of us going in. Now, Utah, you know, Utah is Not only is it known for its snow, it's rather heavily populated with a certain segment of the population. So if you could imagine a dozen or so brothers coming into TGI Fridays, we're like, we're going to make an impression. Man, nobody lifted their head. This is my first impression of Utah. Like, everybody just kept eating. I was like, okay, so we have it. Nobody looked up, nothing. And you never know where you're going to go. I hadn't been to Utah. You know, you hear stories and stuff, so that's fine. Then every department that I considered majoring in, that I wrote down to, what are you thinking about majoring in? I was like, oh, business administration, psychology, yeah, maybe this. You know, I'm throwing down all these things. I met with the head of every department when I was at Utah. They scheduled appointments with me. Now, one thing I noticed on my other trips was basically Sunday, as I was leaving town, I sit down with an academic advisor and talk about, oh, how are we going to help you get through this, that, and the other. Now, at Utah, I met with the head of the departments that I was even considering majoring in. So that right there, to me, I was like, okay, but these people actually care about me as a student, too. You know, and they actually care about me succeeding past this. And then there was just something different, man, with Ron McBride and the people that I went on my trip with up there. And then my dad was the final straw for me, because I was still thinking I was going to go to USC, excuse me. And a coach that was there at the time, he was having an interesting tenure. And I'll let you guys look it up. I don't want to throw him under the bus, but he wasn't. It wasn't necessarily – we didn't feel like the information we were getting was the most truthful with respect to my recruitment. And it was and some comments were made about, if I don't go to this to USC, then, you know, I could forget about my ambition to make it to the next level, which is kind of interesting, you know. And my dad basically said to me, he said, hey, you know, we know now which school's the most serious about you post. And they got something going on up there. And he said, do you think you're good enough? You've had some success and brought some, you think you're good enough to change the direction of a program? He said, you can go to USC and be like all these other fish. He said, you can go to Utah and start building your own pond and changing the way the water and the direction it's going. Are you that good? And I was like, okay, don't try me. So yeah, I went to Utah. And that's when I left, we were in the top 10.
Well, okay, so let's follow up on that, because you had two good years there, right? And then We know, if you're in Atlanta or a longtime Falcon fan, you get drafted in the seventh round, which, I mean, everybody wants to be the first, the second, the third, whatever it was.
Oh, yes.
What did you start to hear as you were finishing up your senior season about the NFL's interest in you, and how shocked were you that it ended up being just a seventh round pick?
Well, I dropped my ankle. So last game of the season, so when I got to Utah, at first, like this whole class that of the guys that were recruited with me, there was a bunch of, one of the other reasons why I decided to go, there were 16 of us on this recruiting trip. Now, 11 of us knew each other already. Of the 11 who knew each other, 7 committed. 8 really, but 7 of us actually showed up to play. One of us is still in limbo somewhere in Utah. We found him, but he never showed up to play, but it's okay. But and that kind of changed things for me too. And then when I got to Utah first, we were running a totally different offense. Now, I will be honest, I did not come in the best shape. I was kind of like, yeah, I'm the man, blah. I came in there kind of heavy, not the way I wanted to, but I still showed up and did some damage. But it was a different offense we were running. So, like, halfway through my last year, we totally shifted the offense to focus and a spread offense, quite similar to, I had a couple of games where they were like, how is he not getting the ball more? He moves too well. And Jerome Bettis had been making an impression, okay? Now, the bus was a year in front of me, and he had made that impression at Notre Dame, and then he went to St. Louis as a rookie, and he was he went to Los Angeles, the Rams, and he was tearing stuff up. And we started to adapt some of the things that they were doing, and I was like, man, look out. And the first time they let me be the feature guy, I snapped. And then I remember we were playing against San Diego State, and I had had a couple of really good games, and it was like, oh, Marshall Faulk is in town, and then you better watch Jamal Anderson. So that, to me, was all the challenge I needed. Man, I ran over San Diego State like them dudes said something about my mama. I mowed the team down, man. It's like, oh, he outrushed Faulk. I put numbers on him. And that was like one of the first times me and Faulk, he was like, you a bad boy. I'm like, I'm going to see you again. I'm going to see you again. I got hurt the last game of the season. We played our rival, which is BYU, and I literally almost broke my ankle in that game, and it hurt me, and I was kind of hobbling around. Regardless of that, I still dusted them. I still put 3 touchdowns on them. We still tore down their goalposts, and I was limping the whole second half. But when I went to the combine, they scanned my stuff, and they were saying they didn't like the way my ankle looked, and then they were saying I had to come back for rechecks. So what I realized is, like, even though my workouts are fine and physically fine, I didn't love my numbers at the combine, like my 40 numbers. I think I ran like a 4.61, like a 4.62. In my personal workouts, and remember, that's when the Indy turf was trash, I was in the 4.5s, and I felt good. But I don't know what happened. And it was a different – I'd like to chalk it up to it being not like it is now, where everybody's really looking at everything. We were not – we were just coming up then. We weren't on the big stage. Our national TV games consisted mostly of – if we made it to a bowl game. You know, it was a different time back then for Utah. So I didn't have all of those lights on me. And then there, people were telling me I was a tweener, like, no, he played fullback. And then they switched the offense and all this other stuff. There's actually a great clip of Lynn Styles. Like, I did a Path to the Draft special on the 94 draft, and he's talking about me, about how I went off and they changed the offense and then I got hurt. And I was like, man, they really factored that into it. And so I thought at first I was going to be a second-round pick at Kansas City. And so I mentioned him, Schottenheimer and those guys, and Marcus Allen was on the team. Now, believe me, I wore 32 since I was 7 years old. When the Kansas City was talking to me, I was like, you know what, guys, and I won't even mind that Marcus Allen wears 32 because it's been his longer than me. I'm okay with it. Like, I thought it was a done deal. I'm like, ooh. So second round comes up, and we're sitting there, and I'm like, man, Kansas City about to take me in the second round. Boom, Kansas City Chiefs select running back from Miami, Donnell Bennett. They selected a guy who's very similar to me, big dude just like me, very talented at Miami, but he had a lot more publicity than me. And that's who they took in the second round. Then it was like, my agent's like, oh, there's some teams and some interest in the third round. Nothing happened. Fourth round, nothing happened. Actually, the Raiders, I was like, oh, the Raiders might take you in the fourth round. That didn't happen. I love the Raiders, so I was like, there's no way. When the Falcons called me in the seventh round, Aaron Jones literally told me, first words, hey, we're going to draft you. We were all shocked and surprised that you were still on the board. We thought somebody drafted you in the third or fourth round. I thought you were gone. And then I could hear him in the background going, yeah, man, we thought it was gone. I was like, oh. Now I know. Here's the thing. I'm kind of a smart guy. I know what that means financially. And I was like, don't tell me that, coach. I know there's a big difference in the signing bonus between a third or fourth rounder and a seventh rounder. But I appreciated the sentiment, you know. So I never talked to the Falcons at all. I had conversations with one of their main drafts on their scouts on the West Coast. And I feel terrible that his name escapes me. But I think he probably is the reason I was drafted by the Falcons. Because I didn't speak to June. I didn't speak to anybody in upper management. I had no idea whatsoever. When it was like Atlanta, I was like, Atlanta Falcons? What? And now here's the thing. I grew up and when I got to L.A. as a Raider fan, so I was like, well, they do wear silver and black. But I knew nothing about the team outside of Jesse Tuggle, Rising, and Dion, you know.
Hey, are you tired of shopping your car and home insurance every single year? Well, somebody's got to do it. But that somebody doesn't have to be you. At The Rose Group, we can get you up to 10 insurance quotes in less than 10 minutes. Visit us online today at rose-group.com.
It's a new year, which means it's time to try something new. And I'm talking to you folks who have not yet tried the Daily Draft in downtown Woodstock. I hope you'll go see my friend Sean Daly. That's, get it, the Daily Draft. This is the ultimate sports bar experience. So as the football playoffs near, and then baseball's around the corner, knock on wood, and all the fun springtime things that will happen in Atlanta, you're going to want to enjoy it at the Daily Draft. It's downtown Woodstock on Main Street. What you're going to find? A craft beer bar, self-serve taps, big screens all around you to catch every view of the big game. And when I say a big screen, they have a movie-sized screen with a front-row seat right in front of it that you can grab if you get there at the right time to enjoy all your favorite games. A chef-inspired menu with soup, salad, sandwiches, flatbreads, you name it, they have everything to find everybody exactly what they want when you're going with the family, a boys' night, or a date night. TheDailyDraft.net is where you can find all the information about some of the nights like Trivia Night, Kids Eat Free Night, and more. TheDailyDraft.net. Go find them downtown Woodstock on Main Street. Tell them Matt sent you. You'll love The Daily Draft. Well, talk to me about that because, all right, culture shock, right? California, Salt Lake City, cross the country to Atlanta, yeah. And Jam is drafted, for those who don't remember, into a run-and-shoot offense that June Jones is running at the time. And for the first couple of years, you didn't get a ton of work. So how crazy was the living, the professional, all the transition?
Well, you know, and remember then, too, draft slot was a big thing. Now, it still matters, and you still see, like, first and second-round picks, they're going to get a multitude of chances. Sans them really putting somebody 6 feet in the ground, they get a lot of opportunities in the league, you know, because of the usually, at least especially back then, it was the initial investment you had to put into that athlete. Now, there's a whole different rookie scale now, okay? But seventh round picks back then, the first round pick for the Falcons, or at the time, we didn't have a first round pick, Anthony Phillip. Bert Emanuel was a second round pick. Anthony Phillip was a third round pick, but they were light years when it came to like publicity and hype ahead of me. It was like when you got picked in the seventh round back then in 94, especially in 94, it was like, if he makes a team, man, that'll be something. I was basically like a free agent. There was no expectation for me. Okay, so after about the fifth round, they were like, these people, if they show up and they make the team, and heck, we really picked good, you know, but to come in and actually do something, oh no. And so it was a trip, and we were running the run and shoot back then. And I came in into what I was about to be my first meeting, and at the time, the running back coach, his name is Ollie Wilson, and he came back and worked here for a while. Still coaching in the league. So I would come into the room for like the first little meeting, mini camp meeting, and I see on this little whiteboard the names of all the running backs, and I see Jamal Anderson at the bottom, you know, and I was like, okay. I went up to the whiteboard and grabbed a dry erase marker, and I put an arrow right by my name and put an arrow to the top. Like, you think I'm going to be in? So he comes in the room and he says, what is that? I said, I plan to be the starter here. He's like, no. This is listed by how many years you've been in the league. I was like, yo, Matt, I wanted him to know I was not playing. I'm like, give me a chance, coach. I'm not here to, you know, I was mad as hell that I was a seventh round pick, okay? And I was like, man, if I get a chance. But, you know, Eric Pegram was the guy when I got drafted. They had a guy named Tony Smith,
yep,
who was like a Ferrari, 6'2", 218, you know, run back kicks, catch the ball. He could roll. They just signed, June had just signed Craig Hayward.
Yep.
They just did a deal with Ironhead to bring him in. And then there was me, okay? And so, you know, the run and shoot, it's like, there's, you know, they're going to keep two backs and then one for special teams. You know what I mean? And so I was like, wow, you know, I just had to come in and make an impression. And in the beginning, I was not having tremendous training camps. And we just signed, if you remember, we had just signed Eric Metcalf as well.
Yep.
So Metcalf was there. So he was kind of that hybrid. They were going to move him all over the place, you know? And so I'm like, man, so I really, I credit him as much as I can, but Craig Hayward was a fantastic mentor for me. He took me under his wing. He's from Passaic, New Jersey. He knew and, you know, had met my dad. He knew from stories that my background, that I was born and moved from New Jersey and that the majority of my family was there. So we connected right away. We were both big backs. You know, we both had, you know, we wanted to be in shape and we had to watch our weight. But that guy took me all over the place, man. He taught me so many things about the game. And then just about toughness and the blocking and how to do certain things. He recognized in me, I think, pretty fast that I was a big version like him who could do a lot of things he can do and maybe a little bit better, especially when it comes to the passing game and my movement. And he really was great with me. And Eric Metcalf was fantastic too. Eric Pedram was fantastic. I mean, Pedram was a comedian, but he was fantastic. I really had a good group and a competitive group of running backs, but no, I didn't get an opportunity. I remember like the last preseason game, my rookie year, you know, you get all this talk and you're making all the cuts. And then I was like, I'm just going to go off to make an impression, thinking that maybe I'll get picked up by somebody else. And to be honest with you, I had conversations with my agent. I was like, hopefully, because it doesn't look like the way things were being slotted in. It wasn't like we got to training camp and it was a competition for the position. There was like Pegram's one, Ironhead's two, Tony's three, and then you guys will get reps here. So you don't get you didn't get a tremendous opportunity to show what you could do. And then you're doing scout team stuff and maybe you're not getting the most playing time. So I actually thought I wanted to get cut. I wanted to get cut. And so I can have a chance to pick where I wanted to go. And that was my thing. I was like, well, if this doesn't work out, at least I can then, if I get released, then I can choose. And hopefully there are other teams that want me and kind of let me pass, you know, waivers or whatever. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about
that.
Let's talk about that. So the culture, right? We remember June and Jeff getting into it during that era on the sideline. I remember Hebert came in. So paint me the picture of that culture compared to when Dan Reeves, who came in 1997, and how different those two styles were.
Oh, my goodness. Night and day. I remember there were some – I mean, there were some interesting things that happened. And June Jones was fantastic, man, as an offensive mind and just generally as a good guy and easy to talk to, not a big screamer, had great ideas of things to do. It just didn't work out like with the other side of the ball, or there wasn't the whole issue with Jeff George. And I think there are people who are like, oh, Jeff George was a bad person, this, that, and the other. Man, he was not. He was a good teammate. I mean, I really can't say anything bad about him. He looked out for me, too. I mean, I was a seventh-round pick and stuff, and this guy is, like, asking me to go eat and taking me out, and we're hanging. He was a good guy. I think what frustrated him, you know, when all of that stuff went on is I had been becoming a bigger role in the offense. And he was like, why weren't we doing some of this stuff before? And it was kind of all on his back, you know. But it was a different locker room, man. It was a different locker room. Until I got to the Falcons in 1994, I had never suffered a losing season in my football playing life. And I started playing when I was 7 years old. I didn't even have anything remotely close to a losing season, okay? And we won a lot of championships. And so I'm like, okay, you know, I got there and I'm sitting on the sideline and we're 4-2 now. We're 4-2. I'm not dressing up, but I'm on the roster and I'm sitting on the sideline and we're playing the 49ers and that Andre and Deion fight happened right in front of me. I was like, oh my God, are they fighting? And then obviously a couple plays later, Deion took that thing down the sideline. I was so hot that I was on the sideline in street clothes. But we really, from there, it kind of went down it was just kind of an up and down, interesting season. But it was an interesting locker room too. It wasn't like we didn't have bad guys, but it was a different whole deal, and we just couldn't consistently put it together.
Well,
let's
talk about that though. Like, so Dan comes in 97, and Jam, I'll tell you this from the outside, right? Everybody's philosophy on that was Dan's coming from New York. He's been around Denver and New York, and man, this isn't going to work. Washed up, retread. Right. And then we saw 7-9 happen that you guys finished strong after a slow start in 97. So be honest with me. Did you have any feeling that 98 could be halfway as special as it turned out as 97 was playing out?
Yeah, so, all right, the first game of the season. Sorry, remember in 96, even June's last year, even though we didn't make the playoffs or whatever, I lit up the league. I led the league in yards per carry. I led the league in plus 20 runs. I had over 50 catches. June, this is why I missed June. The dude moved me all over the field. In fact, before the 96 season, that off season, I did not, in passing camp, which was all May in 20, he told me I was not doing any running back reps. He was like, you got great hands, and we need to utilize them this year. I was like, hell yes. Now, I'm lining up behind Metcalf, so I'm like, dog, slow down. But, I mean, I learned all the receiver routes, and it really came to fruition the next year, next season. Now, we could have did some things differently and been more consistent and definitely played better on defense. But, man, for me, especially when I took over as the main guy, like the second half of 90 season, I went off. You know, so there's this big, you know, I don't know if you remember the whole SI story with Dan Reeves. Yep. I'm going to lead the league in rushing. They said, oh, he's going to lead the league in rushing. I was like, okay, whatever. And then I almost broke my ankle the first game of the season in Detroit. I bring this up because I remember, like yesterday, Dan talking about championship teams and how they win in the fourth quarter. We were so damn close in a lot of those games. I feel like if I would have been healthy and I played even hobbled the next several games because Hanspar was so young and we were still learning offense. And I was trying to get acclimated to having a fullback in front of me really for the first time since I was in high school with Bobby Christian. You know, we're trying to get on the same page. There's a tremendous change in the word responsibility, the placement, the structure from Dan Reeves' offense from June Jones' offense to Dan Reeves' offense, okay? Tremendously different, okay? So we are learning how to do all of these things, and I'm, like, hobbling around. But we lost a couple of close games. Now, the reason I felt so good about this team, because once I started getting healthy and once we started figuring out how to – run this offense and this terminology and get on the same page, we were really clicking the second half of 97. Remember, we were on the precipice of the greatest turnaround in NFL history. If we would have beat Jake the Snake that last game of the season, we would have went from 1-7 to 7-1 in one season.
Yep.
And so he pulled that thing out, man, one of the most physical games of my life. I wish they would air that damn thing one time. But that Arizona defense was no joke, and I remember how physical it was. But I had a big game, and you know, he had the heroics at the end. But I felt so good about that team. Cornelius Bennett was there. He was teaching us stuff about how to be a pro, like how to win and over adversity. It was just – you know, William White had come in. We had just had pieces. Ray Buchanan came in, and we all started figuring it out. And that second half of 97, you didn't want to see us. And that was the team. That's what I tell people. It's like people remember 14-2. I was like, hey, man, from about the midpoint in 97, we were 20-4.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't lose a lot of football games, you know?
I think, Jamal, I think everybody else took note, too, in 98, though, specifically, if memory serves, what you guys did up in Foxborough to the Patriots in that 98 season. I think you guys realized how good you were, but I think everybody else, because you guys put a 40 spot or some just huge number on them. I think
a 40 spot on them.
Yeah, yeah, I think everybody looked up and went, okay, there's something going on with this Atlanta team, and then it just rolled from there.
Right, and I don't know if you remember, but, you know, Inside the NFL at the time was on HBO with Lynn and all those guys, Bonacani. Yep. It was a big show, you know. They mic'd me up the week before the Patriots game. And Ted Johnson was the big middle linebacker for the Patriots. Remember him?
Sure.
Basically looked like he looked like Bizarro Superman in pads, okay? Oh, God. Anyway, but I'm hitting. So they, like, we're doing this whole background thing, and then they're like, now we're rolling. I'm rolling that season of 98. They go to Tyson's camp. Tyson's still fighting. My dad and Mike are in training camp. They go film with my dad. They go film with Mike. What's it like growing up with him? I'm like, yeah, you filming for me, Tyson. What? Fool, the Dirty Bird is the man. Anyway, so I'm hitting this heavy bag. And they have me mic'd up. They have me in this gym in downtown Atlanta. And I said, Ted Johnson, this is your head. I'm about to boom, boom, boom. They had that and ran it. And so they're all, you know, if this was been social media, it would have really went crazy. But it went AP at the time. It was like, what do you think about what Jamal Anderson said? He's like, oh, we'll see him on Sunday. Man, you remember in that game when we came up to each other and I stiff-armed him like it was a right jab from Ali versus Frazier? Turn up, I almost broke that man's neck. I was like, boom. And then I danced around the corner and scored on him. I was like, what? I was so hype in that game. And then the final thing was either Chuck Smith had that big sack. O.J. Santiago went off, and, like, they had the mic on him, and he was actually making the bird sounds, and that went everywhere. Now, yeah, we knew. We felt good about anybody who was going to come in to play us, and we really were competitive in practice. So we were like, whoever, let's go.
Well, let me ask you now, before we get to the playoff run, right? So the Falcon fan remembers Dan Reeves has the heart condition, a heart attack late in that season. You guys are trying to win the division. Rich Brooks takes over the head coaching role while Dan is out. First of all, take me through the timeline. Like, how did you learn about Dan? What was the team's response right away?
Well, yeah, we were, the week we were going, we had to go to Detroit. Obviously, you know, it had been a tough place, and Barry Sanders is there. And then it was like that week, Dan, I feel like, was that Detroit week or the week before?
I remember I found out.
Yeah.
I think it was Detroit week.
I know we clinched in Detroit, yeah. So anyway, I got a call at the crib, and I was like, what? And then they were saying that Coach Reeves had to have heart surgery, emergency heart surgery, whatever. I was like, what? At first I thought it was the worst case scenario. But yeah, they were trying to get in touch with, you know, they got in touch with certain people on team and then told everybody the next day at practice. But it was so crazy because so many things were going well for us, you know, and it was just, everything was rolling. It was like we had a very, felt like a generally a good energy. I mean, still one of my favorite teams of all time. The guys on this team, I stay in touch with a lot of them, you know. And so it was crazy when it happened. And then, you know, Rich Brooks came in, and of course, you know, going up to Detroit, you know, we knew what we had to do in order to clinch. And this I said, it's like it's such a Falcon thing, though. Like, we're having on the run of having the greatest season in franchise history. Oh, but the 49ers are like one game behind us. You know what I mean? Like, you know, no surprise that they were loaded. And not just that, there was a team up in Minnesota who was having the franchise best season too. You know, most of the time, if you went through, even from now, if you go 50 years from today all the way back, it's not going to be a ton of 14-2 teams.
No.
But for it to be like 13-3 behind you, 15-1 in front of you, it was a rough.
Well,
there was a lot of good football.
Right, and to have to beat San Francisco in that second round here, and sadly that was the Garrison Hurst injury game, but you guys...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, you guys win that close.
Yeah, fantastic.
All right, so take me through week of Minnesota game, right? Still to this day, one of the greatest games in Atlanta sports history. You guys are double-digit underdogs. I'm sure in the locker room that's the Dorito on your shoulder, and that's driving everybody. So give me like the whole reminder of that week from after beating San Francisco till the time you go to Minnesota.
Well, let me first tell you, a bunch of us are watching San Francisco play Green Bay. The year before, you know, Green Bay won 2 years ago. The year before, they lost to the Broncos. But, you know, Brett Favre was the Falcons. So we're watching the San Francisco 49ers game, and we've already played the 49ers twice. They're in our division. We've already know this nightmare. So we're rooting really for Green Bay, okay? We don't want to see the 49ers. Like, we feel good about it, and we tapped them up in the second game, blah, blah, blah. But man, nobody's trying to see Steve Young and Jerry Rice no damn three times in one season, okay? And so I'm like, when T.O. makes that catch, I was like, oh, gosh, here we go again. So it was crazy how those emotions and then coming in, and Garrison had a fantastic season. He was, like, right behind me. I think he finished with, like, 1,500-something yards. He was balling that year. So it was, like, horrible to see that whole thing happen and then that close game. But, yeah, you're right. We get to Minnesota, man. We get to Minnesota, Matt, and, like, I had this routine of going to the movies, like, the night before games. And so I'm going to go. We're going to decide we're going to go see. You know what we have to go see? Varsity Blues.
Oh, God.
Yes, it was perfect. It was perfect. We went to go see Varsity Blues. So a bunch of the guys for the team decide they're going to roll with me. We go to the Mall of America because they got a movie theater in there, and we can walk around the mall or whatever. So the people in Minnesota recognize us. Now, I'm like, oh, they got a roller coaster. I almost forgot. Let's go ride. Listen here now. It was a line to ride the roller coaster. They recognized me and some of the other guys. It's like, oh, you guys go. You guys go ahead. You've had such a great season. It's like a congratulations for being here. What a great season. What a great season. They were like, this is a foregone conclusion, brother. They let us go in front, and we got right on me. I'll never forget. I actually posted it. I found a picture in a box. Me, Ben Huff, Chuck Smith, Bob Whitfield, Keith Brooking. Keith Brooking was a baby. Keith Brooking is in the picture with me and Chuck Smith on the roller coaster. We had our hands up. You know, this is when they had just started taking pictures on the roller coaster, so you try to find the flash. I'm like throwing my hands up. We like celebrate. This is the day before the game. Biggest game of my life. And I was like, there was just this attitude that we were there as to get the second place ribbon. And so for us, Minnesota had been so dominant that year, they hadn't been in any football games. Again, we played the Niners three times. We were in some other close games. You know, we beat Detroit to clinch, but that was still a dog fight, you know. We had been in some dog fights where we had to overcome adversity and bounce back, okay? We saw that in ourselves, and just wait till it's close. We just got to – yeah, we're going to see what happens when they're in a real football game. We're going to see what happens when we come up there and we're just as physical as them. You know, they had Randy Moss and Chris Carter. Randall Cunningham was doing his – you know, he was on his comeback thing. John Randall, yeah, they were loaded. They were loaded. But we felt like if we put ourselves in a position, especially as the game got down to the wire, that things would bounce in our favor, and that we would at least not crack in that situation because we had been there before, you know? And that's, I can't even tell you any better than that's just how it played out.
Talk to me about the game, though, because I want to talk about the noise, right? Yeah. So give me the noise when Minnesota's up. Looks like they're maybe pulling away to the point where you guys come down with that final drive of the game and tie it, and even into overtime. I bet the noise had to be from unbelievable decibel levels to you could hear a pin drop.
So it's crazy. And Dan used to already have this thing where he'd bring the speakers out and turn up the sound, and we'd be out there. So we'd be out in practice, and they'd have the big speakers and turn up that background noise. Is basically just like almost like you were practicing in the middle of Poltergeist blaring in your ears, you know? And so we had prepared for that. We had did it at a couple of times, figuring the Jets was going to be like that, and going to cities like that, and San Francisco. So we had done this for a little while, but nothing quite prepares you for how loud it was in that place, in that dome in Minneapolis. It was crazy. It was crazy. And so, but it was just a thing. We expected it. But their whole thing in that game was, I was not going to beat them, you know? And I was like, okay. We could, but they stuck with the run, And we consistently were doing things, but Chris Chandler was playing out of his mind. Terrence Mathis, out of his mind. Tony Martin, out of his mind. OJ making big catches. Tim Dwight coming up and doing what he did. And then for me, it was like the checkdowns and everything else. In addition, some of my favorite plays from that game are blitz pickups where I met somebody in the middle of a hole and handled business for Chandler to make a throw. And I was like, it's never been about the numbers for me. It's like, oh, that's your favorite game? You didn't have 100 yards. I'm like, I did. I actually did have 100 yards. It wasn't rushing, but that's my favorite game because of what it meant to the team, you know, and what it meant to this organization and this franchise, you know, to win and go to the Super Bowl, especially there against those odds in that situation. That's far and away my favorite football memory. I remember I was sitting on the bench. And Tony Martin came to sit next to me when Gary Anderson was going to line up to kick his field goal. Tony Martin said, put my head down. Tony Martin said, Jam, watch, look up, watch him. I was like, what? He said, he's going to miss. I'm telling you, he's going to miss. Jam, nobody could be perfect. It's Murphy's Law. I know he's good, but nobody could be perfect, man. I'm telling you, he's going to miss. Watch him. Watch what I'm saying. All right, Tony. I lift my head up, and sure enough, I told you, we ran out on the field. I was grabbing my helmet. I was like, oh, my goodness. It was crazy.
Well, and on top of that, you mentioned the blocks and the pickups you had. Chris Chandler's fourth quarter, that last drive especially, some of the throws into overtime, they were as – like, had it been John Elway, it would have been legendary stuff because Chris didn't have that
legendary.
Same – yeah, you know, because Chris was just that big. So you guys win that game, certainly biggest win in Falcon franchise history at the time. And then remind me, Jam, you guys had 2 weeks, right? You were still in the 2 week before the Super Bowl?
2 weeks, yes.
Okay.
2 weeks.
All right, so a couple of things here now. To this day, people still bring it up, and I don't know if it's nitpicking or it's real. Dan, in some people's mind, made a mistake by letting families come to the Super Bowl. It was different than any other road trip, and we all know what happened the night before, which we'll talk about. But, like, did you even at the time acknowledge that was a big deal at all to treat it differently?
No, because of how he was. He was all about the families. I mean, Dan was a coach, like, we used to travel to the West Coast, like, on Friday, you know? And if you had family there, not Saturday, we traveled to the West Coast. We did not take a trip to the West Coast my entire time playing with Dan Reeves. Not once where we didn't travel on Friday. In fact, in 97, we played the Seahawks and the Chargers back-to-back. We flew to San Diego, and we were the demo team in the Super Bowl hotel, and we stayed in San Diego the entire week. So he was all about that. And he was big about, like, when we got to cities, if you had friends or family, he was about you meeting them. He was about that. He's all about his family. He's very close with his family. Pam is fantastic, his wife. That just was the atmosphere, you know, and that's what he was about. And you know how people, you could just tell when certain things are very, very genuine, you know?
Sure.
It's like Dan Reeves doesn't have, like, a false bone in his body. You know what I mean? Like, if he's mad, he's going to grunt or this, that, and the other. But, like, that's how he was. And so that was our expectation. I don't think that had anything to do with how we played.
Well, tell me about the night before then, because it's been talked about round and round, and I've talked to different players on that team. How did you find out about the news about Gene? What was your night before the Super Bowl like?
Well, I know everybody can't say anything about the night before because there was only a handful of us that were informed because of the time. Mostly everybody found out the next day. And here's what I like to say, and I really believe this. You know, for me, I was most concerned with him. He was such a big part of why we were there. He was such a fantastic leader. He's been outstanding in the community. I mean, he was there out to win the Man of the Year award, you know? So I just was about supporting him, you know? I wanted to make sure he was okay. He mattered more to me than anything else. And Gene is a fantastic locker room guy. He was really great picking up younger players. He made big plays for us that year. So I was like, I didn't know anything else but to support. My first, only, and forever inclination was and is to support him. I feel like to this day, you know, it sucks what happened, and I'm sure it has, may have affected him, but I don't blame him. I never have, never will, still won't. I feel like we did some things that were out of character for us, and we were undefeated that year. If I ran the ball 20 times, and then we didn't give up big plays like that, and we did. And sometimes it is what it is, man. It was written that John Elway was gonna literally ride off in a white on a white horse, and it just is what it is,
Yeah.
But like it was crazy. Like I remember Toback and getting banged up in that game, and I was just like, oh. I wish we would have done things so differently. And my biggest factor is probably the first series, because we marched down the field and then gave up that sack where I kind of was out in the flat. And it was a very similar play that we ran when I scored the first touchdown in Minnesota. And we were not able to pull it off because Romanowski came through and sacked Chris, and we had to kick a field goal. But we marched right down the field on them, and I feel like if we would have scored a touchdown there, it would have made such a difference in that game.
So, Jim,
we did some things and just
it was just different than the rest of the year. Well, all right, so we started by talking about your dad. Let's end by talking about you as the dad. So your dad, I imagine, was tough on you growing up. How are you with your kids? Are you similar, different than dad? What is Jamal Anderson, the dad, like compared to his own?
I'm very much, I think, like my father. With mine, I wouldn't say like I'm supportive as I'm very, very supportive. I think my girls are fantastic. Obviously got pretty daughters. It makes you nervous, but my boys are doing well. I feel like for me, it's about trying to support them. I don't try to, I want them to be supported and fulfilling. Fulfill their dreams, whatever those things are, I think my oldest daughter is a star. She's an unreal student and fantastic person, and she's been that her entire life. I'm like, well, I feel like sometimes if she didn't look like me, I'd be like, maybe it's not come from me, but her mom is fantastic. I know. Oh, gosh, I know. But she's, then my middle daughter, Madison, is singing right now. Actually just posted a single she's on with another artist we're friends with, and she's doing that and going to school. And then my youngest daughter, she's won the state championship, and I feel like there's a very big school in Georgia that she's going to be making an announcement that she'll be going to soon. So that's going to be fun. We're looking forward to that. And little Jamal, he's taller than me. He's already 6'1". He's going to be in ninth grade, and he's preparing for football right now. So my oldest boy is in California. He's doing well. He's enjoying the waves right now.
I'm going to put it this way. I'll say this. Playing football was easier than this dad stuff, man.
Yeah, there's no question about it, especially if you have a high-profile dad like me who still makes news and is in the news here and there. There's always that balancing act, and so I try to be very real with my kids and supportive, and they've been around this stuff for a long time, and my brother working for Will.i.am, and sister works in the industry, so they've been surrounded by like that, but they're very level-headed and good people and better friends, and that's what I'm most proud of, and whether they're great athletes or whatever, I want them to be good people, and I feel like they all are, and that's a fantastic testament to their mom and where I'm also a help,
Yeah. Well, Jamal, we'll leave it there. That's great stuff, my friend. Can't thank you enough for spending the time with us, and I know the city of Atlanta loves hearing about some of those great times and those great tales. Thank you, my friend.
Man, I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody, so much for taking the time to listen to this week's edition of Welcome to Matlanta. Thanks to our producer, Matt Lear, for his assistance with the program. He's the glue that keeps the operation running. We'll talk to you next week on Welcome to Matlanta.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets.
The winningest team in baseball also has the most saves, and people who save the most money are winners. So start earning saves by investing in Worthy bonds for only $10 each. These bonds earn a fixed 7% APY, and there's no fees, penalties, or minimum balance required, and they can be redeemed whenever you like. You can even round up everyday purchases to buy additional bonds. Go to worthybonds.com/save. That's worthybonds.com/save, and save and win.
When you buy a used car, don't be taken for a ride. Get Ford Blue Advantage certified at Wade Ford, Atlanta's headquarters for factory-certified pre-owned vehicles. Go to wadeford.com. There, you'll find a great selection of Ford Blue Advantage certified used cars, trucks, and SUVs. With Blue certified, nearly all makes and all models are in stock now. You'll find something perfect for just about any budget. Buy with confidence at the Wade Ford factory-certified used car outlet at wadeford.com. Wade Ford. We are Atlanta's Ford dealer.
Spring is here and baseball is back.
You can't forget the Derby. I love the hats. Do you have yours yet?
My hat? I treated myself to a whole outfit.
If you want to be able to treat yourself, then you should check out the Nest Savings Account at LGE Community Credit Union, where they want you to reach your savings goals faster.
Take it from a pair of 680 The Fan wives. Head to lgeccu.org to find out what makes their team number one in Georgia.